Welcome to
America's Cannabis Conversation,
where you can hear experts from all facets of the cannabis business as to what's happening in this exploding industry. Keep yourself informed. Join the conversation. This is Dan Perkins with your American Cannabis Conversation. Quick news. New Orleans, Louisiana. Louisiana lawmakers vote to allow medical marijuana for any debilitating condition and legalize delivery services. The Louisiana House Committee approved a bill on Wednesday that would significantly expand the state's medical marijuana program by letting doctors issue recommendations to patients for any debilitating condition. Lawmakers also advanced in separate legislation to allow dispensaries to deliver products to patients' homes. The action represents a rare legislative victory for the cannabis reform in recent weeks, as the coronavirus pandemic has largely halted proceedings in the states across the country. Both pieces of legislation, approved by the House Health and Welfare Committee, were sponsored by Representative Larry Bagley. They now move on to the full House for debate. Minneapolis, Minnesota. Top Minnesota lawmaker unveils long-delayed best marijuana legalization bill in the country. It was mid-February when Minnesota House Majority Leader Ryan Winkler pledged to introduce what he called the best legalization bill in the country within the coming weeks. Shortly after, the state plunged along with the rest of the country into the global coronavirus outbreak, and marijuana reform was put on ice. Now, as states begin taking steps towards normalcy, Winkler has finally revealed the promised bill, introduced Tuesday with 33 co-sponsors. "Our current priority is responding to the COVID-19 pandemic," he said after filing his legislation. "But after the town halls and the discussions around this issue, we will still want to put a strong bill forward. As we look to come out of this crisis as a better, stronger Minnesota, we need to continue working toward legalizing cannabis for responsible adult use in Minnesota." And now for our last story, Newark, New Jersey. Worker fired by Amazon for medical marijuana wins key decision in federal court. A former Amazon warehouse worker who sued the company after allegedly being fired over his use of medical marijuana is better positioned to win his case following a procedural ruling by the federal judge this past week. Last year, the ex-employee filed a suit alleging that he was terminated after testing positive for THC and subsequently requesting a disability accommodation for his anxiety disorder to allow him to use cannabis in accordance with the state law. And last week, he scored a small but significant procedural victory. After he sued last year in New Jersey Superior Court, Amazon filed to have the case moved to the federal U.S. District Court, where the plaintiff stood little chance of winning, given that the United States laws prohibit marijuana regardless of state policies. But in the latest development, a federal court granted the ex-worker's request for a motion to remand, meaning the dispute will be kicked back to the state Superior Court for consideration. The reason the judge granted the motion is because the plaintiff, who is known only by the initials DJC, filed to amend his suit by adding his former manager to it and removing references to the Federal Americans with Disability Act. With those amendments, the suit sidestepped both factors that allowed Amazon to have the case transferred to the federal court in the first place. A quick program reminder. We now are on 6 days a week, so you can hear quick news, new editions on Wednesdays and Saturday. Let's see who's joining the conversation today. Joining the conversation today is Morgan Fox from the National Cannabis Industry Association, who's going to talk about legislation to allow the people who work in the cannabis industry to be treated the same as everybody else in qualifying for federal benefits. Next, we have the cannabis doctor on call, Dr. Jordan Tischler, who's going to talk about isolation and depression and how cannabis might help people, the millions of people who are dealing with it in today's pandemic. Cody Sanchez returns, talks about qualifications for the CARES Act and the cannabis businesses. In our last segment, we're going to talk with Craig Behenke and Mike Regan, who are equity research analysts at Marijuana Business Daily, Investors Intelligence. They join us to talk about what's going on in the cannabis markets and gain some insight as to what's happening as a result of COVID-19. So let's get on with the show. I'm Dan Perkins, and thanks for listening. Welcome back to the conversation. And joining us today is one of our regulars, Morgan Fox, who works with the National Cannabis Industry Association as their public communications director. And here to talk about is a position that the industry has taken about the rights of employees in cannabis industry to apply for these stimulus packages. Morgan, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me again.
Let me just turn the floor over to you and let you talk to our audience about what the issues are.
Well, unfortunately, due to the federally illegal status of cannabis, most businesses are not going to be eligible for SBA loans or other forms of relief in federal stimulus packages. And this includes indirect businesses, not just plant-touching businesses. So we've been working with other industry groups as well as advocates to try to get language inserted into these various stimulus packages that would make cannabis businesses eligible for relief. We started really ramping up the pressure in late March when we saw what the potential impact of the coronavirus response was going to be, and we started seeing businesses suffering. And just looking ahead, realizing that with all of the other financial burdens that are placed on cannabis businesses, that a lack of federal relief was going to slow down the recovery process even more and force many businesses to close. So in late March, we started pushing for access in the CARES package. And unfortunately, Congress was moving so fast that they didn't really consider too many other additional issues that could have been contentious. So we weren't able to get relief in that package. And now we are working with our champions in Congress to try to get that language included into the CARES 2 package, which would essentially allow both direct and indirect cannabis businesses to be eligible for those SBA loans and would protect SBA employees from federal prosecution for facilitating those loans. We're hopeful that we can get that language included in the CARES package, but if not, Congressman Earl Blumenauer and Ed Perlmutter introduced legislation last week that would specifically allow the SBA to provide those loans separate from the CARES packages. There has also been some talk about trying to get banking access included into the CARES package. And we heard some positive feedback from that from congressional leadership, including Nancy Pelosi. So hopefully over the coming weeks, while this relief package is being debated, we'll be able to build support for allowing these businesses to be able to access the funds that all other businesses are able to access. And, we're cautiously optimistic that that can happen in the very near future.
In your press release, you talk about these are my words, not your words, but conceptually it's what you're talking about, is fairness. We ask these people to come in and service the needs of them who are dependent upon various marijuana products for their life and well-being. And we ask them to take risk because we think that they are an important part of our economy that has to be kept open, like drugstores and other places. And yet at the same time, the people who are virtually potentially risking their lives to provide service to the customers are excluded. And I applaud you for what you're doing. But listening to what you're saying, and don't take the butt the wrong way, listen to what you were saying. Things could go rapidly and be monumental change in the industry virtually overnight if what you're after, including the banking, happens?
Well, I think that it really depends on whether or not those changes are made permanent or whether they're specifically made to impact the federal relief funding. I think that's a really big distinction, and it really depends on how much support we're able to get from members of Congress. But even with federal relief, there's still going to be a lot of barriers. Just because banking is made easier doesn't mean that financial services institutions are going to be jumping over themselves to start working with the cannabis industry right away, or mm-hmm. that every bank is going to do so. There's also the issue of all of the pre-existing difficulties that cannabis businesses face. Even if we're able to get banking relief and funding relief, there's still the issue of the inability to deduct business expenses on federal taxes. There's extremely high state and local tax rates. There are the additional costs imposed by staying open and implementing additional health and safety precautions. And things are going to add up and are going to make it a lot more difficult for the cannabis industry to recover with or without federal funding. But without federal funding, that process is going to be monumental. And we're going to see a lot of businesses, unfortunately, have to close, and that might lead to a lot of consolidation. You know, all these pressures on the cannabis industry are always going to affect small businesses more than others. So if we want to keep small businesses alive and throughout the remainder of the coronavirus response and afterwards, and we want to maintain uninterrupted access to health care that these businesses are providing, we need to give them some support.
Well, I would agree with you. I look at what's going on. We have states like, I believe, Massachusetts allowed the medicals to be open, but in restricted hours, and no adult use. And I don't even know that it's open yet in Massachusetts. So those people all lost their jobs if they're working on the recreational side and they're not doing medical. So there are people that have already lost their jobs and have been out of work maybe approaching 2 months that are going to be looking for work. And the question, as you pointed out, what happens to the survival if mom and pops can survive? I mean, we had this huge downturn in values before the virus came in, 60% last year. Going into the virus, we were down 43% this year. You have to wonder how many businesses can actually survive. And is that good for the industry or is it bad for the industry, Morgan?
I mean, I think in general, when you have small businesses folding, it's going to be bad for the industry. It takes away from competition and variety and innovation, as well as limiting the number of jobs that can be created in this sector. And we're going to need those jobs, especially as we start moving into a recovery period. Also, I think the consumers are going to suffer from that as well, because they won't have the ability to necessarily access craft cannabis.
Do you have a sense, speaking on behalf of the industry association, you have a sense of, are there any positives in what's going on?
Well, I think that one of the biggest takeaways here is that, first of all, that the access to cannabis has been considered essential in the majority of states that have functional cannabis markets, and all of them have allowed for continued access in some form. I think that recognition of the cannabis industry as a vital part of healthcare and the economy is really a huge step. In terms of public acceptance and in terms of raising the profile of the industry. And then the way that the industry has responded to this issue, I think, is really going a long way towards not only improving the reputation through things like being first to adopt safety precautions and guidelines, going above and beyond those guidelines in order to ensure the safety of their customers and employees, as well as helping with the response in terms of doing things like making hand sanitizers and masks, and in many cases, donating those to frontline responders. So, we see a growing acceptance of the need for continued legal access. We see the cannabis industry really showing its best self and practicing corporate responsibility pretty much across the board. Along with that is going to come some real challenges, not only on the business side, but also on the policy side, because Congress is clearly going to be concentrating on coronavirus response for the foreseeable future. And that shortens the window that we're going to be able to get standalone legislation passed this year. That's definitely a challenge, but I think that overall, the first two things I mentioned are going to help increase our chances of passing really comprehensive legislation in the near future, probably sometime like next year or the year after. we're building support, we're building momentum. It's just the fact, like, this whole situation might slow things down a little bit.
Unfortunately, time really flies when we have you on the show. You have such interesting things to say. Is there the website for the industry? Does it have the story, a position paper, whatever the right word is, about what you're trying to do relative to get equal pay for people?
Absolutely. You can find that information on thecannabisindustry.org. There should be a number of stories crossing the front page. And we also have a number of webinars that we've been putting out steadily since lockdowns began that not only touch on this issue, but also discuss a number of important issues facing the cannabis industry, including things like sustainability, crisis communications, and ways that businesses can give back to the communities that are supporting them.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you. We've been speaking to Morgan Fox of the National Cannabis Industry Association, and he's a regular on our show. If you didn't get a chance to hear all of Morgan's conversation today, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com, and you can hear his entire interview and other ones that he's done by going to the archive section. So, Morgan, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll be right back.
You're listening to America's Cannabis Conversation on W420RadioNetwork.com. Your new cannabis electronic checking account can offer you PIN secure credit and debit cards for your clients. We can place a cashless ATM at your checkout counter, which reduces the amount of cash on hand. Did you know that we can help you bring legacy cash into your new cannabis electronic checking account? No more paying with cash. Making payments with your electronic check is safe and secure. So if you find yourself up at night worrying about somebody breaking in and stealing your cash, consider a cannabis electronic checking account. To find out if a cannabis electronic checking account is right for you, call 888-420-8884 and ask for Dan Perkins. That's 888-420-8844. W420RadioNetwork.com. Want to find out if cannabis can help your medical condition? It's time to hear from our cannabis doctor on call.
Welcome back to the conversation, and joining us today is one of our favorite guests, our cannabis doctor on call, Dr. Jordan Tischler. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
It's always I get more comments about your segment than any other segment we do on the show because people love your candor, your simple way of explaining things, and it's just it's always a pleasure to have you on because I know it'll be a good show. We talked in the pre-show about what's going on in the country, and we talked about the impact of this prolonged isolation, and it appears that the next phase is the elderly, those quote most at risk, are going to continue to be isolated as we allow other generations to come out into the community. We just got a notice last night here on Sanibel that they're going to be opening some of the restaurants next week for outdoor dining, but it's strongly suggested that people over 65 stay in their homes until further notice. So,
which on Sanibel means everybody, right?
Yeah, just about.
Right.
There are about 1,100 school kids, but that's it. So what I wanted to ask you about is I've been reading about this isolation is causing an increase in people suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And we did a show some time ago on anxiety, but what I want to know today is, are you hearing any of this in your practice? And if so, what are you doing to help your patients who might be dealing with a new version of PTSD?
Yeah, I think everybody is suffering under the weight of this isolation. There's no question. Whether this isolation that we've endured so far, or more of it as things go on, will really lead to, you know, something that rises to the definition of PTSD. I don't know. I don't think anybody really has enough time and perspective on that at the moment. I certainly hope it doesn't. But I think that, you know, regardless of the true definition of PTSD, we're certainly seeing people have considerable anxiety around this. Perhaps people are developing some depression as well. God knows I have anxiety around this. So, every conversation I have with my patients these days is about how weird this whole thing is and how unpleasant and protracted it is, and then what we can do about it. And so, you know, what can we do about it?
I'm sorry, I apologize for interrupting, but
you
gave me an opening there that if I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask you. What, if I heard you correctly, even you have some depression. What are you depressed about? What do you have anxiety over?
Well, I don't know that I think I have depression at the moment, but I certainly have anxiety, and my anxiety ranges on a whole bunch of topics. First of all, just being cooped up in the house makes me feel stir crazy, right? I need to get out and do stuff. I'm never been the world's biggest extrovert, but I'm also not the most happy introvert. And so I miss socializing with the people who work for me. I miss going out and seeing my friends and those sorts of things. And then there are sort of the bigger ticket items, like, you know, I'm worried about my elderly parents who are in their 80s, and my mother-in-law. And I'm worried about the fact that I read recently that the farmers in the Midwest are killing all their pigs and their chickens because they can't figure out how to get them processed into market. And yet at the same time, we know that there are people who are hungry in this country, which should never happen. One can have this snowball effect for going from sort of the personal on up to sort of this global doom and gloom feeling, that, you know, maybe somewhat of an overreaction on my part, but there's a lot of gloomy evidence. So I think, you know, the one that really gets at me actually is that I have a teenage daughter, and you know, she's doing her schoolwork and stuff, but the fun has gone out of it. And so I worry that, you know, to your question earlier about PTSD, if we think back to my grandparents' generation, who grew up during the Great Depression, their fundamental perspective on the world, on spending, on saving, and essentially on the security around necessities, food and shelter and that sort of thing, was fundamentally altered by the Great Depression, and it informed who they were for the rest of their lives. And I would really hate for this to negatively influence the trajectory of my daughter's life. And that one keeps me up at night for weeks on end. I think there's a lot to be worried about.
I'm not going to try and put you on the spot. I'm just curious, as you as a medical clinician, there seems to be more and more rhetoric coming out of the criticism that the medical community, the doctors who were advising the president, had too much influence over the president, and that it was their lack of a better description, doctor scare tactics, caused the president to react the way he did and to do the things that he did for this country. Although he did say, has said on many occasions, he wants to make sure that the cure isn't worse than the illness. And clearly we had another 3.8 million people who were joined the unemployment lines. We're close to 30 million people now.
There are some people who wondered if it was ever necessary to start with, and that the clinical people got too much control. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I got to say that that strikes me as completely wrong thinking. And ultimately, this is not a economic or legal or policy decision. This is a purely biological phenomenon, and the best wishes and plans of our government at all levels is not going to influence the way this virus behaves. So ultimately,
right.
This comes down to either we take steps that prevent the rapid exponential transmission of a virus, or we let humanity essentially get wiped from the planet. And I say that realizing that that sounds very, very, very frightening and alarmist is the word I'm looking for. But we have to understand that in this case, the rate of transmission is higher than in previous pandemics. And the kill rate is higher than most recent pandemics that have wiped millions of people from the face of the earth, and that the efforts that are being made now do not solve this problem. And this is a key point. They cannot stop this. What they can do and are doing is preventing people from dying needlessly when the medical system becomes overrun with cases. That's that whole flatten the curve thing. That's buying us time. Time for what, you ask? The reality here is the only way we get out of this situation is by either developing natural immunity, which we don't know yet whether it happens or not, or we develop a vaccine. And so what we need is time for us to figure out how we can essentially immunize the population so that this virus becomes less of a threat, or maybe even a non-threat. The great example of this that happened just last week was that Germany had imposed significant restrictions and had flattened the curve to the point at which the ratio of transmission was 1.0. That means for every infected person, there's only one more person who gets infected. So that becomes a linear, non-exponential growth rate. And ideally, you would like to get below one, but they got down to one, which was hugely important. And what they did last week was they made some very minor adjustments to their policy to, facilitate poking people's poking their nose out the door kind of thing. And what they found was literally in one more week, their transmission rate had gone back up to 1.1. What they calculated was that at a transmission rate of 1.1, their medical system would collapse by September. And that if the rate goes up to 1.2, it will collapse in July. And if it gets up to 1.3, their medical system will collapse by June. That is huge. And I threw a bunch of numbers at you. It's very hard, I think, from my own perspective, to look at this stuff without the years worth of experience in this field that I have, or maybe even with it, and look at that and say, what does this mean to me, right? All I see when I look around is how miserable I am and how, everybody is struggling. And so I think it's not unnatural for people to be critical of these measures, but the reality here, unfortunately, is that these measures are doing what they need to do, which is keeping people from getting really sick and dying in the greater droves that we're seeing now. Let's remember that this has been going on for, 2-3 months, and we have lost more Americans than we lost in the entire Vietnam War, right? In three months, the Vietnam War, arguably was a 10-year period. So
right.
We need to not underappreciate the kill rate here and realize that that's with our best efforts. And if we stop making those best efforts, that's just going to go shoot through the ceiling. So on that cheery note.
Yeah. Well, what I want to do, Doctor, is we're going to end this segment in a moment, and then we're going to come back and we're going to be more specific about how cannabis might help people deal with the depression.
Absolutely.
So, sounds good. As we end this, Doctor, thank you for joining us today. And how can people find more information about you and your practice?
Great. Well, my name is Dr. Jordan Tischler, and my practice is called Inhale MD. And not surprisingly, you can find a wealth of information on our website, which is called inhalemd.com. And let me just say that, generally speaking, I'm much cheerier to deal with than I have been so far in this segment. So I welcome people to reach out to me through the website.
Thank you. We've been talking to, as you just heard, Dr. Jordan Tischler, our cannabis doctor on call. If you missed any part of his show, and shame on you if you did for this segment, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com and you can listen to this show or any other shows. Thank you, Doctor, for joining us, and we'll be right back.
Introducing the new Cannabis Electronic Checking Account. Did you know that in 2019, almost one in five dispensaries were either robbed or broken into? Your business is cash only, because up to now, you didn't have access to a banking account that would allow you to deposit the daily receipts from your business. Some owners have started a banking relationship only to be told in a few months that the institution was closing the account. For the first time, you can now have a reliable business checking account. Yes, I said a secure bank electronic checking account. For more information, call 1-888-420-8844 and ask for Dan Perkins. That's 888-420-8884 and ask for Dan Perkins. W420RadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back to the conversation, and joining us today is Cody Sanchez, who is a partner.
Entourage Effect Capital, or EEC.
You're in San Diego at the moment, and that's your office. You also have an office in LA and one in, you said, I think, in Fort Lauderdale, which I thought was heck of a commute. So thank you for joining us on the program today. One of the things that is on a lot of people's minds is, especially in the cannabis space, what, if anything, can I qualify for? And there are some people who are saying, well, nothing, because you're in a controlled substance business. And there are other people saying, well, that's not totally true. So I invited Cody to come and talk to us about the CARES Act and how it relates to, if it does, to people who are in the cannabis business. And let me be very specific. I'm not talking just about dispensaries. I'm talking whether they're growers or processors, anybody who's all involved in the cannabis business. So, Cody, welcome to the program, and we're anxious to hear what you have to say. So tell us how the CARES Act can help, or will it, people in the cannabis business?
Sure. So this is a question that I think anybody who is a business leader needs to consider, because if there's free money on the table in a time where the government has induced a coma into your business, our stance is that you have every right to ask for those relief. But our understanding is, in tandem with speaking with your attorney, you should definitely be asking about the eligibility for this, especially the tax credits that you can take as a company. The loans may be more difficult, but from a tax perspective, our understanding, as far as we read it, is since there's no application required, there's no reason that wouldn't be eligible to cannabis companies.
So if we think about it for just a moment, I understanding in the legislation, there was a change between the Senate and the House, where the Senate had a more liberal interpretation, and surprisingly so, the House had a more conservative interpretation, and it was what the changes that the House made is creating all the questions. But I wanted to make sure that I heard what you were saying and our audience heard what you're saying, because I made the distinction between a dispensary and a grower or a processor or packager or machinery builder, whatever,
who don't actually handle the product but are related to the cannabis industry. Are you saying that those people who are not involved in the actual sale but are in the cannabis business indirectly may qualify, or did I misunderstand what you were saying?
I think that's right. You know, all of these are educated guesses, and we have to disclaim the heck out of them because I'm neither an attorney nor a tax specialist, an accountant, nor am I these individual companies' financial experts. So giving the, the litigious aspect out of the way, that is our understanding, is that especially when it comes to things like the employee retention credit, which allows for, you know, payment of employees during the crisis, which is something that you just don't pay on your taxes, that to us seems like something that you can put forward on taxes across the board. And it seems like one of the worst things that can happen is you have to have that recalled back. One thing you do have to be careful about is that the way that you're applying the application in no way indicates fraud. So you need to be fair and honest about the company that you actually are and what your company is employed and engaged in. But the tax credits we think are interesting. And we have, like I've said, seen ancillary companies like you mentioned. That would mean people that sell services to cannabis companies or hemp companies have gotten some of the actual loans that they have paid out through the Paycheck Protection Loans 7A provision.
Now, there are people who say that the banks are being unrealistic, and I mean that's where I didn't use the word that they're treating these loans as if these were loans that the banks were going to have to add to their portfolios. It's my understanding that if the bank makes the loan, the government is the ultimate guarantor and will pay the bank back, because if the borrower uses the proceeds for what the government wants them to use it for, within 6 months, the loan is forgiven. So the banks really don't have any credit risk, but there were some people in the government who were complaining that they were going too far. Have you heard any of that?
I mean, well, first of all, there's a massive wait list that these banks are dealing with at this point. I mean, we had one portfolio company that put in for the PPP at 12:03 p.m. It opened at 12, and they were the 48,000th entry. And so they're dealing with, one, just a massive unprecedented inflow. And two, yes, the government has said that they will forgive these loans, but the important word that you said is if. They'll forgive the loans if it was used in the proper manner, if the company is actually eligible, if it was done in the correct way. And so whenever the government does that, the banks are assuming some credit risk. So I fully understand why they have to go through a little bit of due diligence. They cannot be doling out money without a process when there are quote-unquote ifs involved that could leave them holding the check.
But on the other hand, if we look at the up to $10,000 income, that's not even a loan. That's basically a gift, a grant from the government. So there's no credit review involved in that. And yet those apparently are taking a long time to process. Is it a matter of just sheer volume?
I do think it's a matter of volume, and it is also a matter of, you know, these banks aren't set up in order to confirm what they've been given at this sort of speed. So all of these do require an application process besides those credits that you yourself will put into your tax payout. And so, you know, the banks are in no way, shape, or form set up to handle this many thousands of applications and
right.
to verify that the information that you put in is correct.
Right.
So we have
right.
to give them a little bit of slack. I mean, I think the biggest issue really stemmed down to the fact that the government tried to get out stimulus in a massive way very quickly. And then, you know, of course, looks to blame the private sector for not enacting their regulation fast enough. But if you look at the CARES Act, I mean, it is not short. This is a long act that takes some, like I've already said to you, I mean, we're all trying to understand this bill. And so we have to disclaim and we have to say we think this is our understanding at the current moment. It is far from black or white.
Right. Now let's go back to your business for a second. I just did a news update that'll be on the show on Saturday, and I now do it twice a week about what's going on in the industry. And and I'm finding for example, in your home state, through last Friday, the Marijuana Control Commission or whatever it is for the state of California reported that sales in the month ending last Friday were up 17% in the state of California. They were up something like 14% in the state of Washington, down in Nevada and Colorado. But Ohio just had a record. Illinois, 3 months into the recreational cannabis, looks like they're going to do close to $100 million in new sales. And we have places all over the country where they didn't get shut down by the state government. Recreational or adult use cannabis is doing extremely well. So it would appear, except for the ones like Massachusetts and some others where they shut down the adult use, nobody shut down the medical use that I can find. So those places where medical was available, and the 33 states that only medical is available, it would appear on the surface that the cannabis industry has come through so far this coronavirus situation extremely well.
I mean, I think that's correct. I think it's too soon to tell if we will start seeing a renewed focus on price and consumers wanting to go for the least expensive product to deal with the fact that they don't have income. But at this stage, I mean, we've seen 78% increase in cannabis sales across the board on a year-over-year basis, and increase in delivery. And the part that I think is the most interesting, besides being labeled an essential service, is the fact that net new consumers, so these aren't just typical cannabis users consuming more, these are onboarding of new consumers at record levels to the tune of anywhere from 100 to 200% increase, depending on which market you're looking at. And so we are seeing new people come into the industry.
As I look at, I live in Florida, and we were only medical, and we're in the top 10 as far as cases and deaths in terms of coronavirus. We're now expected to maybe not peak for another month from where we are now, one of the last in the country. It seemed to me even before we had this pandemic, that home delivery service for cannabis products was unnatural. And I got to believe that when we come out of the other side of this and we go back to whatever normal times are, I got to believe there's going to be tremendous interest in starting delivery services as opposed to creating bricks and mortar. What do you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm of two minds about it. I think the future of cannabis will have a huge component of it, much larger than it is now by multiples, as delivery. I certainly would prefer to get, you know, cannabis delivered as opposed to going to the dispensary every time and or wait in line. But that said, the one, there's not a huge alcohol delivery industry. So I kind of look to them for comparisons. Alcohol is largely consumed on site, very different from cannabis. On site meaning bars, restaurants, as opposed to cannabis in a home. So there's already a difference there. But the other part about delivery that's tough is it's very hard to do delivery and make money. And we've seen that because, you know, Ease has continued to struggle, limited its product set, now creating proprietary products. A lot of these other small groups, I mean, they have a margin of like 15% on average in tandem with handling these massive logistics. And in a state like California, which tries to make its contractors that are drivers employees, which is very onerous. So I am cautiously optimistic as a consumer that delivery will be of increase, but I am not sure as an investor that the business model as is makes sense to me completely.
Well, unfortunately, with that, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us today. We've been speaking with Corey Fraser, and she's a partner in
Entourage Effect Capital, or EEC.
And somebody wants to get in touch with you. How do they reach you, Corey?
I think the best way is probably LinkedIn. I'm very active on the platform, and so are we. So if they reach out to Cody, C-O-D-I-E, and then Sanchez, S-A-N-C-H-Z, I'm happy to have a conversation.
Super. Well, thank you for being on the show today. And if you missed part of this conversation with Cody, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com and download this show and other shows and increase your education. We'll be right back.
America's newest and fastest growing cannabis-focused radio network is expanding across the country and looking to add to our sales and marketing team. America's Cannabis Conversation offers listeners insight and information on the exploding world of cannabis. It also gives advertisers the opportunity to reach a hyper-targeted audience, literally neighborhood by neighborhood, in markets all across the country. We're looking for a few motivated individuals that want to essentially run their own local business in markets like Boston, Las Vegas, Reno, Orlando, and more. To learn more about this exciting opportunity or to apply, visit americascannabisconversation.com.
Welcome back to The Conversation. In these difficult times, we've brought in a couple of experts from Marijuana Business Daily Investor to help us begin to look at what's going on. We got Craig Behnke and Mike Regan from
MJ Biz Daily Investor Intelligence.
And we're going to talk about markets and valuations and where do we go. So, gentlemen, thank you for joining us in the conversation today.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks for having us.
Okay. Our pleasure. So let's start with the first situation. What is the, as they are calling now in Washington every Friday or every afternoon, what's the anecdotal information that you're hearing from the industry about the dispensaries?
We've heard some pretty interesting information, and is that quite a few states have designated that the dispensary businesses are essential businesses and are to remain open. Now, there is a little bit of differentiation from state to state. In certain states, that means the medical and the adult use can remain open. In other states, it's been a little more restrictive. You do need to have a medical card, so truly only the medical is deemed essential. And then there have been a lot of precautions that have been taken by the retailers, where at these dispensaries, they're offering multiple different ways that consumers can access product. And that's really helping with the social distancing. And the things they're offering are, they really run a range of things. It's home delivery. It can be curbside pickup, or it can be a reduction of the number of people in the store such that it's much easier to maintain the appropriate distances. So, yeah, there's a lot of activity going on at the retailers in order to adapt to the conditions on the ground right now.
Thank you for that. I would like to offer some anecdotal evidence to see how you would react to it. It seems to me, based on what I'm hearing as I talk to dispensary owners, especially in California, but across the country, that home delivery is going to be on the other side of this pandemic. When we get out of this, is probably going to be a very significant portion of the industry. What do you guys think?
Mike, if you want to.
Well, I guess you're basically saying in terms of a more significant portion versus the dispensary side in terms of, I guess, possibly in terms of, once people get used to, delivery, perhaps they'll continue to, have that change in behavior versus going down to a specific dispensary. I guess you've sort of seen that with just the general Amazon effect across all retail. I think if that actually does happen, then that's going to, shift some more power to the brands of the product versus the versus perhaps the dispensary itself. You know, the dispensary experience itself may become less important.
Well, one thing that I did hear is home delivery. And the company noted that they really aren't going to offer that because of the incredibly high costs for this company associated with home delivery and the negative effect it would have on their profit margins.
When people begin to look at entry into this business going forward, starting up new businesses, whether or not dispensaries may be a much more cost-effective way to enter into the cannabis market on a retail basis.
Yeah, you know, I do think that, and with many other services out there, you know, it's not even specific to cannabis, but there really is a wide array of services available, whether that's, you know, delivery, in-store, you know, kind of the Amazon model. So, yeah, I think all of them will survive and thrive going forward, and it really will be based on kind of what the consumers want. If the consumer wants it, there will be a business that provides that and fills that niche. So, yeah, I think all of them survive going forward, and then it's really just a business decision where it makes sense. Now, it could make tremendous sense to have a delivery model in a densely populated urban area where it, you know, the economics of it makes sense. I don't think a home delivery model would work in Alaska where, you know, people are maybe 200 to 500 miles away from where the delivery occurs. So, you know, some of it will be based on the reality on the ground of, you know, what you can actually execute in terms of driving the product to get the people. But I think, yeah, it will survive going forward. It's going to be a great model where it works. And, you know, as much as customers want it, it will be delivered and offered to them.
I live in Southwest Florida on an island out in the Gulf of Mexico. And I'm living around me, both onshore and offshore, is the retirement center capital of the world. And high rises with thousands of people in them, and all of them seniors and you know, assisted living facilities and independent living. There's a high concentration of people that I think would benefit. But let me move on. These dispensaries, have they seen, you know, 25, 50, 75% decline in sales or 10% or less? Do you have any sense there?
This is Mike. MJ Biz Daily has actually been publishing data for California, Washington, Nevada, and Colorado pretty much almost daily. It's a daily basis starting in, you know, March 19th for these four recreational states. You know, Colorado then dropped down to down 40%. Washington was down 14%. California was up 8%, but remember, California was growing more like 25 to 50 before. So, you know, that's sort of a growth. Mm-hmm. That California sees hyper growth go down to moderate growth with some of these. But as I think people are now starting to go through their product, you know, even just yesterday, Colorado is now down 11%. California is now up 25%. Washington's up 17%. And Nevada, I'm actually even sort of surprised with this, is only down 17%.
So do you think part of that is the change from the 15 days, stretching it to 30 days that they realized their inventory was down? Would you expect to see this 318 million units come drop a little more in coming weeks, or hang in there?
Well, it was, I just want to clarify, it was 311 million milligrams sold for the last 2 weeks. And, you know, I'm not really sure.
Okay.
If I had a crystal ball, I would be down in on an island with you sipping a cocktail right now, because I would have made so much money in the stock market.
So speaking of the stock market, in the time that we have left, the industry was off, equity prices were off about 60-65% in 19, and before we got too much into the crisis, they were off another 40. What are your thoughts about who's going to survive and what the price recovery might look like when we get on the other side?
What you need to look for is to be able to have the cash balance sheet to survive to realize the growth in the industry, because it doesn't matter how well the industry does. If the company you're invested in doesn't survive and the bondholders basically own it, then the equity is worthless regardless. So
right.
You have to basically make sure the company first has, you know, the balance sheet to survive or generating its own cash. That's the other thing, is a lot of these companies, you know, sort of assuming that capital markets would always be open, went more for a growth strategy that burned a lot of cash and didn't generate cash soon, you know, as opposed to like Trulieve is actually generating positive EBITDA, so they're more able to like self-fund a lot of their growth just through their own cash operations. But in terms of the analysis we did was comparing the valuations of other consumer and pharmaceutical and agriculture companies in past downturns, and our general conclusion is the valuations on cannabis companies are getting closer to sort of where normal, if you will, traditional consumer companies had bottomed in the past, but they're not quite there yet. It's proven that if you can find the good business that has the good strategy and a good balance sheet to survive, you know, the valuations are starting to get to places, and some of them are actually already there, but they're getting down to where other consumer companies had bottomed and then showed, you know, pretty strong returns out of market correction.
I'm curious as to what you think with this prolonged shutdown and closure and self-sequestering and all this, is it going to have any impact on the availability of product in the near future? Is the supply chain still going to be able to function?
What we've heard from the company so far is that they aren't having any issues right now, any meaningful shutdowns along their supply chain. But I will caveat that statement by saying we've really only heard from a handful of cannabis companies that have already publicly reported their most recent quarters and have addressed the situation. They've said that they aren't experiencing any significant or meaningful kind of shutdowns along their supply chain. But we're also very early into this situation, so we really don't know how it's going to play out in the long term. But the information so far is that most of them are not seeing any significant disruptions. But if you're people can't get either to the grow facilities to actually take care of the crop, or they can't be in the manufacturing facility or the packaging facility, or can't, you know, drive the trucks to ship it. If those start to shut down in the process, then yes, you know, you can make the conclusion that there will be a supply constraint. But, you know, in some states, a lot of them are deemed essential.
We've had a great conversation with Craig Behnke and Mike Regan. How can people follow you and get your information?
The service is MJ Biz Daily Investor Intelligence. One of the easiest ways to find us is if you log on to our website, MJ Biz Daily, and then you are able to actually navigate through the direction bars there up at the top. You can actually see. And I'll just go to that right now. If the people click on investing, you then get a dropdown which gives you several options. You can choose about investor intelligence, and that will bring you to the homepage, which will explain about the service and if people want to become members, exactly how to join and get access.
Then the webinar, the virtual briefing we did, we were going to have a conference in New York yesterday, which because the virus got canceled, but that the content of that conference is actually going to be available for free on at that, you know, MJ Biz Daily /investing virtual briefing. So you actually see the more detailed webinar that Craig and I did a couple days ago. We'll have additional ones about every 2 weeks with basically most of the speakers that we're going to go talk in New York until all the shutdowns happen because of the virus. So
terrific. Well, Craig and Mike, thank you for joining us on the conversation today, and we'll have you back soon.
Great. Thank you, Dan.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you.
thank you for taking part in America's Cannabis Conversation. To hear this show in its entirety or to hear any of our archive shows, log on to americascannabisconversation.com and tune in next Saturday at 4:20 p.m. for the next installment of America's Cannabis Conversation.
America's Cannabis Conversation.